Mr. Miller, good morning.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Would you like to reserve?
5 minutes if you're on, please.
All right. You have it, and we put you at the beginning of the docket to try to get you finished so you could get back to Alexandria.
I appreciate that very much, and I'm very grateful, as I know there's a Commonwealth, for you all allowing us to come here today based on where the scheduling problems were. This is a case in which Mr. Juarez received a life sentence for a violation of 18261, which is illegal intercourse with his minor daughter. There was no DNA test of her, no seminal fluid of his found in her, no medical or any kind of exam by anyone to show whether she'd ever had intercourse at any time in her life, let alone with him. There was DNA on a sheet. He was wearing shorts. There was no blood from her, which there should have been given her condition, on the shorts. And there was no DNA from him on her underpants. She became, therefore, the critical and crucial witness for the case because she's the one who testified about what happened.
How do you explain the DNA from his semen, though, on the sheets of her bed?
There may have been on the sheets, but that doesn't mean 18261, which requires penetration. So there may have been a crime, and I'm not saying that there may not have been a crime or that there wasn't a crime. I'm just dealing with what we have on the crime of conviction that led to a life sentence.
Counsel, could you talk about the procedural bars in this case?
They were waived under 5A13 in the case law that says if the Commonwealth wishes to object to an issue granted by the Court of Appeals, they are to do so in their opposition to the petition. And they did not make any claim about that. When we had a remand.
Isn't that just at the petition stage, though, that doesn't really have anything to do with once the appeal is perfected?
Once the appeal is perfected, if they don't like the issues that were offered to the court, which are the ones that the court accepted, then the court at that point in time is given the opportunity to rule on, do we agree or disagree with the issues, and they didn't object. And the case law on that is rather clear because the case law has said that it's waived. And in this case...
Well, counsel, we still have to have something in the record to review, don't we?
No, because the issue is not whether or not it should have been turned over, which is all the cases they cited. The issue is whether or not the court should have reviewed it in the first place to make a decision.
But don't we have to see it to make a determination on it?
You would only have to see it to make a determination if the issue was whether or not it should have been produced, which is all the cases they cited. This is a different case. It's not whether or not whatever it is should have been produced. The issue is, what is the judge's obligation to look at it, regardless of what it is? Does he have an obligation to look at it? And this judge said, on his own, unbidden by anyone, I don't look at stuff. Because if I look at the disputed discovery, I have to look at all of it, and I'm not going to do it. That's what he said during the motion on the discovery.
Well, he also first said that that he accepted the prosecutor. You know, the prosecutor said, gave the reason why it was not.
No, he didn't. He said in his pleading, in one of the early paragraphs, I don't know of any exculpatory evidence. Then he reiterated that at the hearing when he said there's no exculpatory evidence in this material, talking about statements that the complaining witness made about there being no penetration, which is the specific offense on trial for which he got a life sentence. The prosecutor has an obligation under Kyles versus Whitley that was really clearly expressed by the court not to base what he says on his knowledge. He's obligated to know what the police know. And he didn't say he had read or known anything.
Did at any point he say he hadn't read everything?
He doesn't have to say he didn't. He has to say that he speaks from a position of knowledge. And when he wrote in his pleading that he filed with the court, I think it's on page 6 of the appendix, that I don't know of any exculpatory evidence, that's inadequate. He has the burden of establishing whether or not he's done a proper review. Look what happened in Keener. The defense lawyer, after the evidence is in, talks to another lawyer and finds out in Keener versus Commonwealth that that other lawyer's client was a participating, cooperating individual who set up the entire case and without whom there would be no case. which was exculpatory, led to a reversal, and the Commonwealth didn't share that with the defense attorney. Maybe he didn't know from the police. Who knows? Good faith or bad faith isn't the issue. They have an affirmative obligation, particularly when we're in a situation.
What case says that?
Augers and Kyles versus Whitley say that, and Brady says that. In Augers, there's certain discovery that you're required to give from the U.S. Supreme Court, even if you don't ask for it. And if the person who reported this case was the stepmother, the person who reported that the complaining witness said, "I told the police that there was no penetration," was the same individual who the Commonwealth said was so credible and believable, we're going to put her up as our witness at trial. And so the issue is whether or not it's in there. Look what happened in Wolf. In Wolf, everything's over, everything's over. What did they not conceal? What did they conceal and not turn over? That the police told the key witness against Wolf, "You can avoid the electric chair if you implicate Wolf." It's not in that sentence, but that's the communication. What else did they conceal? That the decedent was the subject of an internecine battle with a West Coast drug ring. There was a possible hit out on him, and the guy who was part of that fight was at a nearby local airport motel when this thing happened. They heard about all this from the DEA. We don't know who shot the guy, and it could have been them, and all of that was concealed from the defense, notwithstanding everything's turned over, including everything turned over during the process through the entire state of Virginia, including habeas. So prosecutors can make mistakes. They have a duty under Kyle's to look first.
Well, where's some evidence that the mother or the stepmother would have or did change what she said about the victim? In other words,
she never changed anything. The mother never changed anything she said about the victim.
Well, what's your basis for the claim here?
The lawyer tells the judge in the hearing, "The stepmother told me that the complainant told the police there was no penetration. Not that there was no crime, but there was no penetration."
And where's the evidence of that? Just the representation of
the
counsel?
Evidence, you don't have to present evidence to prove that she's telling the absolute truth, which is the statements the police have, in order to get somebody to look at the statements and see whether or not it's there. It's not a voluminous record. No one ever said that there were thousands of pages. There could have been six.
Well, we don't know what there is because we don't
know. Well, the judge says it's my policy not to look, and the question before the court today is that okay? Is it okay for a judge to have a policy, "I don't care what it is, I'm not going to look"? You can't have a policy where "I don't care what it is, I'm not going to look." Because if you do, then the court's not acting as the neutral arbiter between the sides. One guy goes, "Well, we understand from a Commonwealth witness, not from somebody on the street, but the person that was so intimately involved with the complainant that the complainant said what happened and she told the authorities, and that's where the case came from." So it's not somebody loose, it's somebody who's intimately involved and who the Commonwealth considers important, reliable, and essential to their case.
But to get to Judge Decker's, the subject matter of her earlier question, how do we know whether, if you assume for the sake of argument that it's error, how do we know whether it's harmless or not when nobody's asked to have the documents made a part of the record?
The refusal to look cannot be a harmless error analysis, because a harmless error analysis is something that you look at when something is turned over or not turned over, and you determine its impact on the case. This is a step before that, and that's the difference. That's why this case is different, because it's a step before. It's not a case susceptible to harmless error analysis.
But aren't we required to look at harmless error in every instance?
No, you're not.
There are certain what case law says that?
Well, certain procedural things are important enough not to be susceptible to harmless error analysis. If a judge had a motion to suppress a warrantless search, and he said the motion's denied and took no evidence, that's not a harmless error analysis. You don't know what the evidence would have shown as to whether or not the suppression should have been granted or denied. So the procedure that was involved there is just fundamental denial of due process. He has a due process right to call for evidence in his own behalf, which could be those reports, and the judge says, "Well, I'm not even going to bother to look to see whether or not they're there." It's like the subpoena deuces tecum. in the subpoena due she's taken in this case, she was subjected to a forensic analysis by a mental health expert. What is a forensic analysis by a mental health expert? It's a mental exam. It's not the Rorschach and the MMPI and all of those other tests, but it is a mental exam, which is covered by 3A11B1. It is also, he asked for her statements. Her statements about what happened. That's exactly what the Court of Appeals said was failed to turn over in Cox. And they didn't even go whether they would, what they would have done for the case or not for the case in the Cox case, the Commonwealth case, which we cited. The failure to turn them over, statements about the event, which is what he narrowed his request to, was error, because they were statements about the event from a third party, which are material, regardless of what they said.
Mr. Miller, I just want to let you know you're into your rebuttal time.
Yes,
you can continue.
I would like to reserve, if I may, Your Honor. Sure. Thank you.
Mr. Jeffrey.
Good morning, may it please the court. Donald Jeffrey from the Attorney General's office on behalf of the Commonwealth. To answer a couple of questions that came up earlier, I don't think there is any authority for the notion that this is structural error, and in fact, this court's most recent case, and the name's eluding me right now, I remember it's out of Sussex County, and I think it was something about a judge precluding a witness from testifying, and the court actually said in that case, we don't have a proffer of what the witness would have testified to, and this isn't structural error, even though the judge flatly refused to allow the witness to testify. I think our courts, the U.S. Supreme Court, have said repeatedly structural error is very narrow, and as Judge Decker alluded to a moment ago, there is statutory and case authority from both appellate courts in the Commonwealth that the presumption is you do harmless error analysis in every case. This case is no different. That's the reason, and I understand the distinction Mr. Miller's trying to make, where this wasn't a situation where the trial court actually conducted an in-camera review, but I think the principle is still the same. The appellant has the burden to make an adequate record. The reason we require that, just like we require the proffer or the offer of proof when you're dealing with testimony that's disallowed or excluded, is so that this court can do harmless error analysis. Both appellate courts in this Commonwealth, and it happens a lot in this particular context, as evidenced by a number of the cases, about half a dozen cases I cited on brief, the court has repeatedly looked at this kind of thing in camera. The distinction Mr. Miller is trying to make, which is that the trial court here didn't actually do it, I think is a distinction without a difference, because the legal principle is still the same. As the appellant, you have the duty to make that proffer, to make something part of the record. That didn't happen here with either thing in question. I'm going to say document, obviously one of tape or a forensic interview, the other are subpoenaed documents. And this notion that Callaway supports the proposition that I can't raise a 5A18 argument certainly is incorrect. And in fact, the court recognized that in Callaway itself.
Can I ask you real quick on the 5A18? On page 43 of the appendix, when the court says, I dismiss the motion to compel the Commonwealth to produce either of the items which were requested. Now that takes us to Ms. Kesey's, and Mr. Elledge says, please note my objection. And the court says, certainly. Now he doesn't say any more than that, but, and he asks them, you know, after that to, if you think I'm wrong on a matter of law, I want you to let me know. And he says, I will, Your Honor. Right. Is the objection there not enough? And the court says certainly.
It's no. Well, you're talking about 518 as opposed to the adequate record.
Right.
And
you
no.
mentioned 518, so that's why I wanted to raise that now.
The problem here is that there's a whole bunch of specific arguments that are being made on appeal that were never made to the trial court. The trial court says, I accept this as a representation of the officer, as an officer of the court. There's never any specific argument that you can't do that as a matter of law, as is being argued here for the first time. There's no specific argument that we have to know for sure that he actually looked at this, or he has to make an affirmative representation that he looked at it before you can even consider it. That's all being raised for the first time on appeal. And in fact, you know, I would take some issue with that latter thing, because I think if you look at the Commonwealth's written pleadings at page 28 and 29, He distinguishes Tuma, which is another Brady case, and in Tuma, the evidence was that the Commonwealth Attorney hadn't actually reviewed the tape that she claimed didn't contain exculpatory evidence. Now, it's a little more oblique than I would like, but I think the only reasonable construction of that written pleading is that the Commonwealth Attorney, in fact, did listen to this tape. And as I pointed out in the brief, there's a place elsewhere in the record where one of the officers who was present during the forensic interview, and I don't know if the court remembers this, but I think they were behind glass and they could hear it. He didn't say absolutely, and the Commonwealth never actually said one way or the other, but he said, I think you, prosecutor, may have been there too. So there's some indication in the record he may have actually been present during this interview. So we have all that. But back to your original question, Judge Beals. No, this court has repeatedly said the objections have to be timely, they have to be specific. Even if you've made a related objection below, that's not adequate. And we come up here with a whole host of things. We've got a judge saying, I think I'm entitled to rely on the prosecutor's representation as officer of the court. That's never objected to. His basis for knowledge is never objected to. And I think that's the problem. All of these things are newly coined for the first time in this court. You have a judge who says, and again, I did this on brief too, I did take issue because I think that while I understand why Mr. Miller's saying what he says about this judge having a blanket policy, I think what he said was a little more subtle than that. He said, essentially, I'd have to have strong reason for going behind that. So he certainly left open the possibility. Again, I'm not taking significant issue with what he said, but I don't think this blanket policy was what's been represented to this court either.
Well, counsel, let's assume it's Mr. Miller's point about the judge having a policy never to look at anything in camera. In the context of this case, would that be a problem?
I don't think it would, because the court ultimately said, I've got an affirmative representation. And again, remember, I think maybe this makes some difference. It was a specific item that was sought, a very specific, narrow item. This wasn't some general Brady request where a prosecutor basically says, I've looked at everything and I don't think there's something Brady there. He knew very narrow thing that the defense was looking for, and he said it wasn't there. So I don't think it would be a policy. I don't think it would be a problem, because again, under the facts of this case, you have the representation of the prosecutor, it was adopted by the trial court, there was never any objection to that. So I think even if he'd said I have a blanket policy, I just don't see it here. Under all the facts, of course, I won't bore the court with the litany of things that I said were defaulted. That's all in the brief. I mean, I'd be happy to read it to you if you'd like it. There are a number of specific arguments that are made here for the first time, and they may all be very good arguments. I would say one thing, and I'll give credit where credit's due. I'm totally plagiarizing this from another context from the Commonwealth Attorney for the City of Richmond, but there's a suggestion on brief that we can't have reliance on representations of officers of the court, i.e. prosecutors, because there have been problems in the past related to that. And, you know, I would suggest to you that I think creating a general rule, which I guess the rule here would be that there has to be a blanket policy of doing in-camera review. Anytime a prosecutor says, I'm an officer of the court and there's nothing there, you still have to do the review.
Not the law.
That's not the law. It's clearly not the law as stated by our Supreme Court or by any other court I'm aware of. And I've got the citations for that on brief. But it certainly would be bad policy, too, because I think the vast majority of times the lawyers make representations, prosecutors make representations like this, they're spot on. So that would be problematic. But again, at a more fundamental level, it was never objected to. And I think there was quite a bit here in this case to keep the prosecutor honest, because two law enforcement officers who were present during the interview were present, they testified, they actually testified regarding the prior consistent statement, which I called a recent complaint, where the victim had said that the defendant had intercourse with her. I mean, it seems to me at that point the door is wide open for inconsistencies, so there was plenty to keep this prosecutor honest in this particular case, because there were too many people running around that had knowledge of what was going on where that could have been approached. So I think that's something that, if you were to get to the merits of that claim, which I say you shouldn't, I mean, I think that certainly should guide your merits analysis somewhat as well.
And the prejudice is an issue, right? Evidence of prejudice.
Evidence of prejudice, I think, is, are we talking about Brady now? The forensic interview? Sure, I think the evidence of prejudice, it is a problem here, because, again, we don't have the adequate record. to determine that. I think that's required. And we don't have, we really don't know what the length of the interview is either. It's a forensic interview, and I certainly suggested on brief, this is not, it's probably not the few pages or whatever it was that was suggested in Bowman. I would assume that in a forensic.
You just don't know.
We don't really know. You know, Judge Decker, to be honest with you, at some point I saw something in the record, I think, that suggested to me it might have been an hour and a half, but it was too vague to, and I don't even remember where I gleaned that from. It was so vague that I didn't even feel comfortable saying it on brief. I finally came up with it. The record really doesn't tell us, but my common sense tells me that just the windup when you're dealing with a sex abuse victim and the types of things that you would do, you don't just jump in and start asking questions. And I think the counselors actually testified to that later. So I think that certainly militates against a finding that it was short or that the review would have been easy. But yes, there is a fundamental issue with the prejudice in this case, too. Excuse me. If the court would like, I'll switch to the subpoena issue.
That'd be fine.
Much of a chance to touch on that. So, in fairness, if you'd like me to rely on a brief, I'll do that. But I'd be happy to try to address that as well. You have the same type of issue, I think, with respect to this that you had with the other thing, with the adequacy of the record. The only distinction that I would make here is that, and this is a long record on this, that there were affirmative efforts to obstruct the court having the record to deal with, which I think makes this even more compelling to enforce the inadequate record waiver. As of course probably familiar from the brief and the procedural history, we had a remand for the consideration of whether these subpoenaed documents were part of the record. Frankly, I think if the shoe were on the other foot and Mr. Miller had brought this stuff up, I can't think for a minute that I would have argued that somehow this wasn't part of the record just because there wasn't a formal effort to say just make it part of the record. The subpoenaed, sealed documents were made part of the record below, and frankly, as an officer of the court, I didn't want to be standing here saying the record's just inadequate and have somebody on the court looking at me and saying, okay, fool, you know we can bring it up sua sponte, right? And P.S., it would have been a pretty easy process for you to initiate the process to get this done yourself, and we wouldn't even have to fool with it. But we tried that, Mr. Miller had that. The circuit courts found that there may have been tactical reasons for it, but at the end of the day, what we have here is an inadequate record, and I would hope that at this point, the court, because of the decisions that were made, isn't going to sua sponte bring that up. I think that you ought to, or I'd ask you to enforce the normal waiver that would occur with an inadequate record.
Because we don't even know that it's there at this point, do we?
I wanted to call yesterday and I didn't ask the question. It was certainly there when we were doing the remand, or when we were dealing with that process, because I called, just like counsel who represented the facility, Collins Center, during the hearing. I didn't think it was appropriate for me to ask the court or a clerk to let me have a detailed look at those documents. What I did so I could make my motion in good faith in this court was, can you pop those open for me, and can you at least tell me that it appears to be things that are responsive to a subpoena in Collins Center, and the deputy clerk said something to the effect of, this thing's got Collins Center written all over the place. So I said, that's good enough. I'm going to let, and I told Judge Ludwig when we were in this remand process, I said, you don't have those same constraints. If you want to pop that open, this certainly the court is free to do that, but I don't think it's appropriate for me to do it, given the nature of the records. If it gets up here and this court allows me, so be it. But I really didn't think it was appropriate for me to go any further. I felt a slight bit uncomfortable doing as much as I did, but I thought it was a good compromise because I didn't want to waste everyone's time if it was something totally unrelated. So that's what we did with respect to that. On page 17 of my brief, I talked about a host of defaults. And again, I won't review the litany of those. This is another situation where I think the arguments are much better in the appellate court. And I'll just point you to that part of my brief is with respect to that, unless the court has specific questions. I've argued in a number of situations that the claims would fail on their merits. I would also point out to the court that Arias, the counselor who did all of the sex abuse treatment, that the interviewing with respect to that, she had also looked at this forensic interview which she did not do. Someone else did that. She had looked at it, but she was there. The defendant had a full and fair opportunity to cross-examine, wasn't impeded in any way, so any inconsistencies or anything that would have flowed from those records was certainly there before the court. It was never suggested to the trial judge, hey, you need to give her an opportunity to look at her file so she can refresh her recollection, or now she's on the stand and there's a reason, there's something that's bothering me, you ought to give me a chance to look at that file. There wasn't any renewal of the motion, so
Do we not know, and following up on Mr. Miller's point to us earlier, do we just not know, or do we do know that there was never an exam that would determine on a girl of that age whether penetration had occurred of her vaginal area?
I don't, Mr. Miller may come up and correct me on this, I'm not aware that there was any indication that it was done. And of course, as the court knows, there was some delay. I don't know that that would have necessarily precluded the examination, but I don't believe that one was ever done, but I might be wrong about that. If
that was my understanding of what he said.
Try to give you an answer, I'll do that. I'd started to make a point because Mr. Miller waived me, or talked about us waiving defaults. I think if you look at Callaway itself, which is the case that he is relying on, that case itself has got language. We understand the Commonwealth is not typically precluded from arguing the Attorney General based on anything the Commonwealth Attorney may or may not have done a brief enough, and cite the cases and the reasons for that. That was a very specific application of very specific rules. We can make all the default waiver arguments that are appropriate and that are made on brief. Callaway is distinguishable, and I would ask that you come to judgment.
Thank you, Mr. Jeffrey.
Thank you.
Mr. Miller?
The only scientific person to testify was McGuire, so they didn't do any kind of exam at all. There's no way she'd ever had any kind of intercourse in her life, which is something that sane nurses and there must be 30 opinions in this court and the Supreme Court of Virginia about sane nurses and what they do. Now, the issue was preserved because under 801-384, the statute, 8.01384, and Galloway say, you say, I mean, 801-384 says, you say what you want, you give the judge a chance to rule on it, he does or doesn't rule your way. The case of Sheldon, Taylor and Jones, where there was a right as a contempt case, the Supreme Court of Virginia ruled and overruled this court, respectfully, that when the court was given in writing, this is what we want you to do, and the court didn't do it, and court said, I read it, and that's all that they did, to say I read it, and I'm not going to do it, that was enough. You don't have to cite every single case and every authority here that you cited down there according to the last case. And so what we're saying in the discovery is that the request was made, statement to the police, the judge has a policy, which is a policy. This is a different case. This isn't your ordinary DWI case and maybe a guy on the corner said something to the officer about the accident. This is a one witness case, specific statement, not by somebody loose, but by somebody on whom the Commonwealth relies about a statement they made that could have meant that it wasn't this offense, it was another offense. It was very focused. And the court said, I don't care how focused it is, if they tell me no, that's the end of it.
Can I ask you on that, Mr. Miller, was it that focused, or was it, that's the question, but you have all this voluminous amount of stuff to review in camera?
No, you don't have a voluminous amount of stuff to review in camera. I just heard for the first time sitting over there this morning that counsel had asked the clerk, and the clerk told counsel that there was the center all over that material. Because when a motion to quash is granted, the material by law is returned to the center. And that would have been nearly a year before he called up. I don't know, he never said anything about that at any time in the remand or to anybody until he told you today. I don't know what's going on there, and I had no chance to address it. And in Lovett, on the destruction of exculpatory evidence, they took testimony. They didn't rely on a proffer from a prosecutor. When a prosecutor proffered—
Well, the counsel, there was no request below to, I mean, when the prosecutor made the statement, the defense attorney...
He could have said, Judge, he's not telling the truth, put him on the stand,
asked,
and put him under oath to see whether or not he's lying.
Well, could have asked to bring the stepmother to prove that there was, you know, some potential... I guess my question to you, and I'm not being very articulate here, but my question to you is, under the standard, trial courts all over the state accept what a prosecutor says. They're an officer of the court. They represent. There's nothing here, Judge.
This is a different. This is not a run-of-the-mill case. This is a situation where someone tightly tied to the witness, for whom the Commonwealth vouches, made a very specific statement. And the lawyer, he could have said, I don't trust the prosecutor, I want you to find out for yourself, but the judge had gone off on his own, I don't do that. When he says, I don't do that, and I'm not gonna look at it, and he's gonna say, well, I don't care that you don't do that, I want you to look at it anyway, because I asked you to.
No, there's two different things here. One is the in-camera review, the other is providing a basis to do the in-camera review.
He provided a basis. The judge took one lawyer's representation, which was very specific and not generally, I think there's something specific there. And he said, I'll take the other guy's representation over yours. And we don't know what
Mr.
the other
Miller,
guy asked a bunch of people.
Your time has expired, but please finish answering Judge Decker's question. And because we've had a lot of questions, I'll give you another minute to wrap up.
Judges often take a prosecutor's representations, and in my experience in trials, Judge, I've looked through the file. It's like in the Almat case, Ray Jackson, when he was not U.S. District Judge in Norfolk, says there's no exculpatory evidence in the file. And Judge Clark looks down at Ray and he goes, Mr. Jackson, did you look through the entire file before you made that statement? Judge Jackson said, no, I didn't. He said, good, we're going to have an adjournment. You can come back later this afternoon and you tell me you did that. Usually the prosecutors have looked through the entire file. They say, Your Honor, I've gone through the file, I've looked at everything, and it's not there. Particularly after Kyle's, when the Supreme Court said, it is your duty to have done that, and you have to know, and you can't make a representation until you have. And in my experience, that's the reputation that's made.
Where's the evidence that they didn't do that?
There is no evidence that they didn't, but the point is there's an evidence that the obligation under Kyle's is an affirmative duty to have done that.
So when the prosecutor says there is nothing there, there's no exculpatory evidence there, why doesn't then defense counsel follow up and say, well, Judge, I just want to make certain that the Commonwealth has reviewed all these materials to make sure that there's no exculpatory evidence there and make the record appropriately?
He could have done that, but there was a dispute.
Not just could have, shouldn't he? If there's any concern about that?
I don't think that an attorney has to have an obligation to ask the court to ensure that the prosecutor's done their job.
You're asking us to do that without counsel at the trial court level having done that, how are we supposed to be in a better position to do it than the advocate?
Well, the real easier issue is the one that was granted, which is that the judge should have looked at it to review to make a decision as to what it was. Because even if the Commonwealth had reviewed it, that doesn't end a specific inquiry. And very briefly on a subpoena deuces taken.
Very briefly.
All right.
Because I've let you go well over there.
All right. The issue is materiality. Materiality means it's more likely than not. That's all. And in the Cox case, the lawyer said, statements by the people at the bank about the bank robbery. That's what I want. The lawyer said, statements by the complaining witness about what happened here. That's what I want. Judge says no. Not material. It's as material as you can get, and the refusal to turn it over and the refusal to review it is error, and we know there was prejudice because there are seven symptoms of these types of cases that are so common and so well known that the Department of Justice has posted them online for law enforcement, schools, doctors, medical, daycare people.
Thank you, Mr. Miller. I appreciate it. I think we understand your argument, and we will it will be submitted, and we will be back in touch with
you. Thank you. One out of seven wasn't enough. I appreciate